Grade 3 Conference, Lecture 25, The Story of Noah. Now, I would preface this by telling the children a little bit about all that transpired between the time of Cain and the time of Noah. And you can read to them a little bit of the genealogy. This will interest them greatly. First of all, the fact that at the end of all things, Noah is actually a descendant of Cain, because, of course, Abel does not have any children. He dies before that. And just to see the great lifespans that people had at this time, you know, 365 years or 900 plus years, Noah himself, hundreds of years. And how do we understand this? Well, it's just enough to tell it to the children and let them marvel at that and just say that, you know, God had given the world so much life at that time that life could go on a long, long, long time, and people only grew old very, very slowly, unlike in our time, where it happens much faster, and living to 90 or 100 is considered an exceptionally long lifespan. How do we understand this in our own terms? Well, Steiner explains that, no, physically, people died then the way they die now. Maybe their lifespans were even statistically shorter than they are now. But when you were the son of someone, it particularly worked through males rather than females at this time. If you were a male son, particularly the first son, when your father died, your etheric body carried the memory of his entire life. That is to say, that was added to the beginning of your life. So now, although you were perhaps 20 or 30, you experience the 70 years of your father's memory. So we might say at that point, you accounted yourself, since you carried his name as well. We still have that tradition, of course, in many cultures of naming the first son after the father. You had his name, you had all of his memory. His etheric body was completely subsumed in your own. Now you were 100 years old instead of 30. Then when you aged another 40 years, so now you were 140. Your son at your death took on the memory of you and your father, and now he at age 30 was 170, and so on, so that after several generations, before these etheric memories simply were depleted and no longer could carry on with the same clarity and vitality, there was a continuation of consciousness over hundreds of years. We do not have this, of course, today. Our own memories are very much our own memories, beginning approximately at age 3, and not taking on the qualities of our parents. However, there are individuals who will say that the stories their parents told them were so vivid about their lives that sometimes they're not sure if that was really their own experience or something their parents told them. So we have little traces of this, but we are far more our own people today. There's not this continuity. We might say that the last traces of this in the Western world are the aristocracy and the carrying on of a bloodline, you know, 500, 600 years or more, in which traditions hold on to this tremendous continuity of consciousness. But it's nothing like what happened then. So certainly we're not going to explain this to the children, but it's just good for us for our own credence of these stories, what are they talking about here? Were people really living that long? No, physically they were not. Etherically, they were. The etheric body had much greater persistence and vitality at that time. Okay, now again, we've recapitulated with the children the story of Cain and Abel and Cain's wandering. We fill in a little bridge talking about the line of descent from Cain, and now we can begin and say, remember, boys and girls, that after the serpent tempted Adam and Eve successfully in the garden, after Yahweh learned what that serpent had done, he did not kill the serpent. He let the serpent live on, but he changed him very much and said, you will not be like a beautiful bird that flies in the sky, that all who look upon it feel a sense of wonder. You will not be like the fierce lion who roars in the jungle and all who hear it feel a sense of fear. You, rather, will sneak about. You will slither around and hide in the darkness and be living in corners and surprise other animals and people when they are unaware. So the serpent lived on, and the children of the serpent and the children of the children of the serpent lived on. And we might say that along with them lived that temptation, lived that evil. It did not go away, but instead, like a seed, it was planted here and there, now and then, but frequently enough, in all of the descendants of Cain. And so it came to pass that men and women living in the world grew more and more wicked, and those who carried evil in their heart far outnumbered those who carried good. In fact, they drove those who were good away from their villages, away from their farms. They made it so hard for good people to live on the earth that finally almost no good people were left. And when Yahweh looked down upon the world, he said, this cannot go on. I began this world with such hope that this would be a place where goodness would flourish, and it has not come to pass. Alas, I must destroy it all. Everything that I have created must disappear in dark devastation. But then he looked down one more time, and there he saw a man called Noah. And he saw how Noah, though he too was a descendant of Cain, how Noah managed to keep the good living within his being. And he brought that flame of goodness to his three sons, and to the wives of those sons, and to all in his family. And so God said, because there is this one good man and this one good family, I will not destroy all. I will save this man and his family from the flood that I am about to bring to the world, a deluge in which all must perish. But I will teach Noah how to save what is best, so that the world may begin again. And then you go on and tell about God's command to Noah to build the ark and the size of it and the animals that went into it. On the first day of your lesson about Noah, you can go all the way to the flood itself. And on the second day, review that and then finish the story with Noah leaving the ark, the rainbow, and the future that God promises to Noah and his people. I would not speak about Noah and the vineyard. You could mention that he was the first to grow grapes and make wine, but I think his drunkenness and what's to follow, which Steiner says is an important revelation of the changing of consciousness, there again, that's more than the children need to hear, and it would be very hard for you to explain to them exactly what's going on. Though we do see there that Noah is naked, and his sons are ashamed to look upon that. So it's as though we have, in the entry out of the ark, a kind of recapitulation of the story of paradise and the fall of man happening. That has to all be recapitulated. The flood is like a great pralaya, as Steiner would describe it in occult science, and the what comes afterwards must rapidly recapitulate the fall, and then humanity is able to go on next. So here again, it does not have to be taken up day after day. It does not have to become a major thing. It's a powerful story. I also, the play that I've included in this conference, Noah and the Flood, is obviously about that story. And because the play is a work of drama, I dare to improve on the Old Testament and added things that are not there. Nonetheless, you can make your own judgment about that play if you find it of interest or not. There are a lot of other plays as well written in relation to the Hebrew scriptures. But I would say again, don't drown in that flood. Don't carry on with it for 3 days, or I know teachers who've done it for 5 days. It's such a wonderful, moving story. Of the many chapters that come in between the story of Noah and the story of Abraham, probably the only one that is any significance for your class would be the Tower of Babel, which again is something that you can tell them in the course of a morning or even in addition to something else. It's a fairly simple story. And we might say it's important for the children to hear because now we see the final fragmentation of humanity, that as a result of sort of the inherent laws of their own evil, which tends to separate people from one another, and which still lives on, interestingly, even after the flood, even after this new creation, now in a way humanity still has its issues. And finally, human beings are fragmented to the point where they do not understand each other, where now they have to separate off into groups of separate languages. Very interesting that we see a kind of redemption of this coming much later in the Whitsun or Pentecost experience of the disciples of Jesus, who are able to speak in such a way, to speak in tongues, that they are able to be understood by everyone, regardless of their language. And we see it again, remember how much as that chronology we looked at showed the significance of what went on in the most ancient biblical times in relationship to our time, this kind of counterbalancing. We see it in the wake of the Great War, the First World War, where Europe and other parts of the world near Europe get broken up by treaties and covenants according to people's languages. This kind of fragmentation of Europe that occurs, which to this day has led to any number of conflicts. So the Tower of Babel is definitely an important story, and a short one. And then it forms the basis now for, well, what are we going to do about this fragmentation, and how can God's will work through the fragmentation now that he has made that happen? And we'll see with the figure of Abraham a new revelation of how God works in the world. I'm going to begin the next lecture by speaking about some insights that Rudolf Steiner gives us, not only about the various figures in the Hebrew Scriptures, but also about the nature of God himself. Who is the God of the Hebrew Scriptures? How can we understand this lofty and yet to some extent, at this point, still relatively accessible being? How can we understand the nature of the chosen people? We'll go on.